Welcome, Emilis, to Christy Walk, and I'm sure you're going to explain your familiarity with Christy Walk in this interview, but Christy Walk is based on Kaurna land.
Yes.
Always was, always will be, and it's where I live. So I'm really looking forward to doing this interview.
I'm hopeful that I'll be reasonably articulate and my memory doesn't fail me too much.
It goes back a long way, the development, doesn't it?
Yes, and when you're talking multiples of decades, bits of history disappear because you're not using them regularly, and so then you have to search back and go, okay, what are... And sometimes the connections at the time weren't obvious, and now in hindsight you think, oh, well, that was a logical progression, but at the time it was very much more accidental and everybody was feeling their way.
Yes.
And I guess if we can reflect that in what we're talking about, then that's a good thing.
Yes, so... Did you begin this whole thing thinking of the Halifax Project, or was it before that?
It was before that, that I was in the cusp of having moved out to the wilds of Monarto and run a soul practice, effectively for a very specialised audience, usually rural, in those days it was rural, standalone power systems and very much passively driven free-running buildings. And without really nodding back to the city. And then when you first got in, it was really about Cherie and me, by accident, meeting at an evening gathering. That drew me back to the city, and we therefore... So Paul and Cherie were running effectively a workshop out on Port Rush Road at the time in their home, and just bringing very diverse people together and having conversations about what that meant in terms of a future where humanity can survive on the planet without excessive consumption, without the conventional drivers of development. And certainly the stuff that I was doing was putting individual families back onto degraded rural land where they had the opportunity to rehabilitate the land because they weren't heavily using the land in their living. And so we were putting people into houses that had greenhouses where you could feed yourself and you didn't need the rest of the land, which was almost always in the rain shadow of the Mount Lofty Ranges and was unusable and was valueless. And they were rehabilitating land and bringing the plants and the animals back to what would have been sustainable in those terms. At a time when none of us really understood what that meant because we didn't really have a baseline to work to. And so the idea of the city having the resources that it needs without degrading the hinterland, which is really the traditions of South Australian development, that Adelaide uses the rest of the state as its food bowl without any real understanding of the connections and the consequences. Mm. And so those conversations with Paul and Cherie as the city-centric people and people like myself with some growing understanding of what the hinterland was really, I guess, the debt that society owes. And the fact that, a bit like the traditions of mining, we get all our money and then we have a legacy left that needs to be rehabilitated, but there's no resources left. And that the city, in its day-to-day living, was doing much the same thing to what were very fragile arid lands. And the possibility that as the city becomes more accommodating and able to sustain, then it can also be part of that replacement, replenishment, rehabilitation of the whole of the state. And South Australia is a good working example because we are the driest state on the driest continent and we are in very nutrient-depleted circumstances. And if we can make that work here, then the rest of us are double.
And that is just so much good sense.
Hmm. And the building of that awareness. And the willingness and the seeing it as a positive challenge rather than something against good economic practice, which was very much in the 80s. The view was we're here to rape and pillage while we can, we'll be okay, and who cares about those future generations?
And we're now
sitting in those future generations. Regrettably, my experience right now is that the development industry is still focused on the bottom line in terms of profits, and the expertise has dwindled, particularly in the housing sector, and so building to minimum compliance is the only message, and that the methods available are truncated back to those things that are written in law. And so when I'm doing jobs, I have builders who now want to re-document my buildings and turn them into minimum compliance buildings. And I have to fight. So I'm not acting as... I haven't acted as an architect for about 30 years. I describe myself as a building performance specialist. And my owners are saying, these are the key performance indicators we need in the end product. Therefore, if you, as the builder, as the developer, can't meet those KPIs, then we're not going to build. You have to take almost a very stranglehold accountancy type mindset with you and make the builder say, these are the outcomes after you've built. If you can't meet them, you don't get the contract. So it's put more onus on myself and my clients to hold the line to get the outcome. And there's a lot of pushback.
How do you find clients that are willing to...
I'm very selective with who I take on. So I've had clients who said to me, oh, it's going to be wonderful, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we'll do half a dozen, and you know, one will be for us and it'll be for free. And the answer is, that's not the way society works. If you're doing speculative development, there are huge on-costs in terms of holding costs and the legal obstacles to other people buying into something that is better than the minimum compliance, which you, the developer, have to carry. So let's not kid ourselves. This is going to take longer. It's going to be harder. Regulatory processes, the approval processes, are not geared for doing better than the minimum. They're all geared around less bad. And if you say, I want to do really good, you are treated as if you're going to do really bad. You're going to be frustrated. You're going to have roadblocks put in your way. Because the people who are the authority, who know less than you do, are incapable of understanding that merit has a positive side that is 3 to 5 times better than the minimum compliance. So the development industry shies away from all these things because they want an easy life. The regulatory processes shy away from it because unless it's written down in law, they don't have... Merit is something you can't codify.
Mm-hmm.
It's about good outcomes. And we won't know those outcomes till after we finish building it and measured it. So I, in 2003, published a booklet of post-occupancy measured buildings, mainly detached housing, which said, that is the standard I know we can achieve, with the three component pieces, one of which is the build form and the inclusions, which are all included in the legal building code of Australia and can be measured in terms of the software, the passive and low energy systems that can be integrated, and the occupancy behaviours of the people. Christy Moore incorporates all three. The regulatory process can only deal with the first one of the three.
Mm.
And it assumes that the other two will be negative. So when I say we will be building a building without an air conditioner, the regulatory person says, I can't accept that. I have to assume that ultimately a very large air conditioner will be put in. And I'm saying our experience over the last 4 decades is you build it for a passive, free-running building. The next owner, after the current one, will pay the premium to buy that because they are favouring those outcomes, whereas the general buyer is not. Therefore, this building will not need the air conditioner. And the regulatory person says, I can't accept that. So despite the evidence, I mean, for 20 years I was a state's building energy expert on a state government authority called the Building Rules Assessment Commission. And there, if there was a doubt as to the veracity of an energy assessment, it would ultimately come to me for review. When I now put in energy assessments of my own, I have building certifiers who have no energy training at all, lording it over me that they are the authority. And it's that reversal in position just through the reflection of time, which generally I find very amusing. Occasionally it really gets my goat, but that's just the real world. And so far we've always been able to get to a point where they understand that I know my stuff and we work it through. But it's amusing when someone without any technical knowledge because they've done a local government course and has great aspirations to be an authority, forgets there is actually a hierarchy to authority. And for 12 years I was actually commissioner on the Environment, Resource and Development Court, which is the ultimate appeal body when these things are... And I occasionally have to remind the certifier that, remember that I actually could talk to my presiding member about this and we could march all this into a court case if you really want to go that far. Mm. So I've been fortunate that I've been able to have, you know, now that I'm supposedly retired, have that background that gives veracity to the stuff that I'm doing. And I mean, when Christie Walk was being developed, we had those problems. But because the regulatory system hadn't really got its hands around sustainability or even minimum energy requirements, it wasn't a big problem because we were in neutral territory. But now that governments have decided, and this, today they're talking about vehicle emission levels, we're, what, a decade behind a lot of the other countries around the planet? And people are doing the standard, oh, it's going to cost more, oh, it's going to be terrible, all that sort of stuff. Once you've actually done it, then you realise it wasn't a problem to begin with. It's simply that we are now able to buy double and triple glazed windows, which at the time when I was sort of building the first of these, that was simply not an option at any price, let alone at an expensive price. So we have moved on. But our mindset is still stuck in traditional economics. And so in my work, I find I have to actually use economic theory and terminology to push through saying, no, the operational outcome is so important that that is the key performance indicator, not how quick and how sloppily we can do it.
And it's cheaper to live.
And unfortunately, the developer, of course, sees that as a negative. A developer who has tied relationships out in industry says, I can buy a really cheap Chinese air conditioning unit. I know in 5 years' time it'll break down, so the person I'm contracted with already knows they have another thing coming in about 5 years when they will sell the replacement unit, and then every 5 years thereafter. So the cost of the original already builds in the maintenance, replacement, upgrade cost for the future. If you build something really, really well, and it's going to be around for 100 years, and it doesn't have that air conditioner, there's 8 to 10 air conditioners sales foregone. And that's, you know, that's bad for the economy. So this is the disjunct, this dysfunctional junk between traditional... I mean, Keynes spins in his grave regularly, I'm sure, because that's not what he had in mind at all. But that is how a section of society who've been very successful for themselves by depositing a lot of costs onto society continue to rule the waves, and the way big accountancy firms and government have interacted has been very illuminating as it's become more public. But that filters down into the day-to-day thinking. And this idea of quality of life can be better actually without some of this junk, that simplification is in fact a good thing, is totally contrary to the whole mantra of continuous growth, continuous redeployment and new. And it's so endemic in society that only a small section of society steps away. It's interesting that those who can afford at least are quite often the ones who are trapped in this continuous aspiration. And so when I started, I was very happy to do a lot of work with relatively limited financial means families. Very few of them now talk to me. The ones that do talk to me are the ones that I come into contact with because of my emergency services work, where, particularly in the recovery phase, and we're currently in the recovery phase for the River Murray flood, a lot of people living in shacks, which the floor level is now below what is now mandated. Beforehand, the floor level was actually pushed downwards because regulation didn't want the buildings to be over looming and they were all two-storey. And now the rules have been changed since the beginning of last year that the floor level has to be about 1.5 metres higher than it was maximised to before, because we know we're going to get the next flood within the next 50 years. and it'll be worse than the one we've just gone through. So there are people trying to jack buildings up higher off the ground with an insurance payout that never really is going to cover, you know, because by the time you knock down the bits that are all destroyed and you put back the infrastructure that was destroyed, there's really no budget left. So, and governments, who've been very, very active, and we're very lucky in South Australia, have a very good Emergency Management Act, the recovery aspect shuts down at the end of this month, officially, because the government employees who've been deployed to it are now being pulled back to their day jobs. I, being an external pro bono person, am allowed to continue, but I don't have people I can now continue back to when I have a political problem. So until now, I've had the opportunity to talk to the recovery coordinator, who can talk to the relevant minister, and we can sort things out, because emergency events bring to the surface all the issues that we have never dealt with, that we've just left lie. There was a bushfire out, they call it the Pinery Bushfire in 2015. A little township that had been drawn up by Colonel Light and never built was completely razed to the ground, and it turned out that the fences were nowhere near the right place. So when you came to rebuild the building, you couldn't, because your building was halfway onto your neighbour's property. And there was no process. Surveyor General was fully aware of this. He says there's hundreds of these all over South Australia. He couldn't instigate anything. The council were the ones, we were very lucky, who could put a bit of a fund together to get the land resurveyed back to what the fences now are, to allow the builders to come in to actually put the buildings back. But they had to have new titles issued. And that whole thing took about a year, and we had to negotiate that. While all of that government process was going on, the work on the ground could continue as if this stuff had already happened. And that took about five different agencies, and I was the person who took the time to go around and basically open doors and make people talk to each other. And the people were willing to do it. They understood the problem existed, but there was no instigation within society to preemptively fix it. And it was a problem that started in the 1840s. The very first farmer put the fences in the wrong place. And everybody had simply accepted this is the way it was. But until all those houses burnt down, there was no mechanism to go, hang on a second, bureaucracy has to be aligned back to reality, not the other way around. And so I learn a lot by the work that I do that goes outwards into other allied fields. And I guess decades of experience of tackling those mismatches. And Crystal Walk's a good example of those mismatches being successfully tackled. But it takes time, it takes effort, and it takes people of goodwill. And so the experience in Crystal Walk of not everybody being of goodwill is a good learning experience about the fact that when you find good people, you really value that. And you give them the public plaudits they deserve for being people of goodwill. And when you meet the people who are, pedantic is the wrong word, they want to follow the rules and only the rules as they have interpreted them, you know you have to go and find someone else. Usually someone more senior. Usually somebody who understands that the world is not perfect and that we have to solve the problems before us rather than simply say, I can't deal with this, therefore the answer has to be no.
And this still building on floodplains?
And in bushfire risk areas, because the floodplain is empty, it's therefore very low value land, it's therefore ripe for making money. The bushfire prone area is appealing to us when there are no bushfires. Now, they are really, living in nature is a really good thing. The fact that there is a cost premium to society and to the owners to do that is never really factored in. And to society, the cost is you need a local CFS unit. You need volunteers who are going to staff that. Everybody in society, including urban people, have to provide money. A fire truck's $400,000. You need to replace that every 10 years. In the same way as you have to replace the sewers and the buses in urban areas. And we forget that interconnectedness and our mutual obligation to one another. And everybody's looking for the cheap way out that suits them. So a quick transportable put onto a block Well, surprise, surprise, when the bushfire comes, it's gone. And our dilemma is that so far our argument is about if you live there, leave early. Because the people who die are the people who say, oh, I'll stay and defend. But they don't have the resources to defend. Or they say, I went through a bushfire before, I know what it's like. Actually, you don't know what it's like because you're going to... The new one will be bigger and badder than the one you were exposed to. And we have the real world experience of it's not the fire that kills you. It's the fact that you rush to your car, which is hard to start because the fuel is vaporising in the carburetor. And when you do get it started, you're rushing down a road you know really well, but it's completely black because the firefighter survived. And so you run into that tree that is just in that slight bend that you've known forever, but you've never gone around that bend at 80 kilometres an hour. And you die, not because of the fire. You die because of all the collateral things around it. And so we're dealing with complexity. And we're not really good at complexity, especially at things that only occur infrequently. So I'm very grateful that I've had exposure to all these things because I can look at it. So if I'm doing a job for someone in a risk area, I will say to them, you will be leaving early. And they'll say, oh, no, we'll stay and defend. Okay, at what level of intensity will you stay and defend? And know when that... There are times when the fire trucks are pulled away because firefighters dying is not an option. Preservation of human life is the highest priority. And the asset, no matter how much we love it, we may have to sacrifice it. And that's tough country. And then after the event, when the insurance company says to you, but you were underinsured, no, let's do the budget. No, that insurance was okay. Because if they can argue that case, they only pay you 80%. So you're suddenly into this morass and all your documents are gone because, of course, the documents are all through the building. It's a reminder to us of how fragile all this stuff is and how we have to work our way through that in a really comprehensive way. And so having a background that started with, okay, what does it mean to be sustainable? And Paul and Shree worked up the 10 ecological principles, which, you know, and Paul's published, and he tells me he now has known us for 2 more books as a legacy to Shree, and I'm glad to hear that because there is an impetus to keep going because the wider world would like us to believe we're all sustainable now, and the answer is no, we're not. And it is a very high goal, and we all struggle to work out what that might mean, and we have to keep re-examining. But having had that background from 4 decades ago, that was the task, and having people of goodwill around us with very diverse viewpoints, all chipping in, all contributing to that examination, is really good, powerful stuff. And the fact that we could do it in collaboration with people like Richard Richards from the US and others is all positive. And we drag that positivity with us. And then we look to, okay, where are we at now? Where are we heading? And on we go.
So in those early days, they were quite heady days, weren't they?
And we were lucky that we had a group of people who had the spare capacity to sit and do the cogitating. Yeah? So I'm in my own practice. I can set my work hours. I can devote a certain percentage of my time. It's going to cost me some money. But the conversation is at a level which is interesting. And when we have debates, they are interesting debates. They're not polarised, development good, environmental outcomes bad. It is where do those two meet and how do we blend them together? And how do we take the good bits from each? And how do we moderate the inevitable issues? And the fact that the interest in the building is from its conception to its ultimate either dismantling or sitting in the landscape as a ruin. Now, that's a developer's interested in that build it and make money, but there's a lot of stuff that comes before that. And there's all that occupancy and the change in society and the readaptation, the replacement maintenance, the upgrades, and then ultimately the building loses its function and is worn out. And you have to say, am I tearing that down, therefore what do I capture out of it that is of value? Well, actually, it's this building we should leave. As a bit like in Europe, we have the church, the remnants, skeletons of churches sitting there, reminding us of periods way before our time where the mindset was so different, where that was the ruling ethos. And we need to be reminded that that exists and it is part of the connection of who we are and what we're about and all this. So that's a much bigger agenda than just what do we build.
Yes, it's all a microcosm of what's wrong with the world, isn't it?
And what is right with the world. The fact that we can sit here and have this conversation is the little sign of we do understand, we can, and if we have the right mix of people, we can make these things happen. The fact that next door we got what we got, well, it's sad, but it'll go long before Christy Walk goes. You know, it'll still be here because there are people here who care enough about it to keep it intact. And the people, whether they hand it on or whether they sell it on, the people who come in will have a similar ethos. They probably won't have the level of knowledge that the current generation has, but that can be taught.
Mm.
And it's taught in the living in. So it's not an onerous education. And the asset value triggered by the very low demands it puts just simply keeps escalating. But that's, again, that's a generational or multi-generational asset value. And so right now, for the next 20 years, we probably won't realise that, but it will happen because the stringency of minimum compliance will keep rising. The fact that these buildings already comply with that future standard means there is a no-cost bonus, whereas the minimum compliance stuff needs upgrades. So somebody's going to have to foot that bill. The example of that is the use of the aluminium facade panels, which were deemed to be non-combustible, but turned out to burn very well. Well, the panels didn't burn, the core, the front core burned. How many hundreds of millions of dollars is there outstanding in terms of just in Adelaide of buildings that need at some time to be done with that load sitting there on the current owners in those corporates with all of the homeowners
each going. Kids as well.
And at the moment we're dancing around that issue because the cost right now is horrendous. There will come a time when those facade panels are contributing to a loss of performance that is no longer acceptable. And the upgrade will be done as part of, and we just have to hope that we don't have the equivalent of a La Crosse building in the Docklands of Melbourne in the meantime.